You're listening to the Arsenal for Democracy, forging and preparing a new generation for leadership. Now, here's your host, Bill Humphrey.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. I'm coming to you on October 5th, 2014, from my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate joins me to discuss a history curriculum fight in Colorado, the new Treasury Department rules on corporate tax avoidance, and Turkey's role in Syria. All that is coming up right now. Arsenal for Democracy is usually recorded in studio every Sunday and is available for download on Wednesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it from WVUD.org on Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is the Arsenal for Democracy. Welcome to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio is Nate. Now, Nate wanted to talk first about a situation that's been unfolding in Colorado that's related to kind of education and curriculum issues. So, Nate, what's been going on there?
Well, actually, in Jefferson County, Colorado, there's been a recent controversy at the school board. Basically, the several conservative members of the school board, and this is something we've seen in many other counties around the country in the past couple of years, but they're looking to adjust the advanced placement history curriculum, AP U.S. history, something that both Bill and I took in high school. And, you know, it was, there were aspects that were a little dry, but in general, I thought it was a decent course. And, you know, Bill, it was just, it provided a bit of a foundation for studies that we've gone on to do. And just, this is something that we're very interested in, so might get a little fired up about it. You know, there was a recent walkout and also a sick out, I believe, which is, I guess, where the teachers basically told their students to get sick or stay home or whatever.
Ferris Bueller it up.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, this is all going on during sort of a conflict over merit pay, I think. So there's a couple other issues in the background, but we'll just stick to this AP thing. So there is a member of the school board, the host, Ken Witt, as well as a woman named, let's get this right, Pam Mazanak. Okay, so she's also a member of the school board. Basically, she was very concerned about the new guidelines for the history curriculum in AP U.S. History. Specifically, she thought that, you know, it wasn't, they didn't focus on the founders enough. They also thought that, you know, that there wasn't enough positive viewpoints on the U.S. presented, basically. So they thought that it was just a little too, you know, critical and, you know, emphasizing the critical elements of U.S. history and not enough focus on the positive. So this is just, this is something that we've seen again and again by conservative school boards. They would like to, you know, censor or alter or sanitize or just clean up, you know, buff a little bit the history of the United States and just leave out some of the, you know, inconvenient parts like the genocide against Native Americans and, you know, slavery.
Internment of Japanese Americans.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, no, specifically on the issue of slavery, the woman, Pam Mazarek, basically said, okay, quote, "Yes, we practiced slavery, but we also ended it voluntarily at great sacrifice." So,
I mean, that raises a whole bunch of questions of what her definition of voluntary is, because apparently if it's internally resolved by military force, you know,
that's voluntary.
Yeah,
I mean, so, everyone just chose it to do of their own volition.
And you found somebody trying to defend
this position. So I was reading in the Colorado Independent just like various topics or various articles about this topic. And there's a libertarian activist named Elliot Fladen, who's an occasional blogger. And basically this writer defends the Facebook post by Pam, the Board of Education member. So basically, you know, Pam had said that she wants high school students to be taught more about American exceptionalism and how America is not just one country out of many. It is, in fact, the best country or the only country. I'm not quite sure what that whole, like, American exceptionalism framework of not one country among many, but, you know, the best country ever in the history of ever. So, I mean, that's a whole lot of nonsense, obviously.
And what was her explanation for how it would have been involuntary?
Right. So going back to this crazy article by the libertarian activist, basically she talks about how, oh, everyone's twisting her words and, you know, the only reasonable interpretation of her remarks about the great sacrifice was the Civil War. So she's not ignoring the Civil War. And, you know, it was voluntary because no other power like Great Britain came in and forced or compelled the United States to change its slavery policies. Yeah, only the other country like the Union versus the Confederacy. I'm pretty sure those were, you know, maybe not technically a UN recognized two different countries, but they were two, you know, powers fighting against each other for control and for the future of the slavery question. And you can't get around that. That's, I mean, North invading the South, that's compelling.
Yeah, and it's sort of ironic that you have the so-called only reasonable explanation or interpretation of her remarks is that the Civil War was what she meant, because there's so many people in this country who still deny that the Civil War was about that. I mean, obviously it was a little bit more complicated in that, like, the Union forces and President Lincoln weren't necessarily primarily interested in ending slavery, but the war definitely happened because of slavery.
Well, and that even undercuts her point a little bit, because right. If you say, oh, it's a voluntary, and then you say, okay, well, the only people that were really voluntary about it were the Northern abolitionists, but when you actually really dig deep into the history there was a lot of conflict between Northern abolitionists and the Union power structure, whether it's Lincoln, whether it's his generals. It's just to boil everything down to all the North was against slavery and the South was for slavery, that sort of ignores some crucial differences that made it a, you know, very divisive and a fractious Civil War.
And even Lincoln would, you know, issue counter orders if any of his generals who were more abolitionist minded, you know, tried to order some slaves to be freed or whatever. Like, there was a lot of that, you know, of how much. And of course, but today still, you know, in the South, you've got people trying to revise the curriculums to say that the Civil War was over states' rights, that it had nothing to do with slavery, that slavery would have died out by itself, blah blah blah. But I mean, the prediction that slavery would have died out by itself, that has been predicted so many different times in the history of American slavery and never actually happened until it was, you know, basically reversed by military force. But if you look
that sort of argument is wishful thinking towards the future from the people that were, you know, a little bit against slavery but didn't really want to upset the apple cart and end it, so that we're thinking back to like the 1700s here, and then people still say that now. You got Ron Paul saying that. And it just, you know, you think it would have happened at some point if it was going to happen, but it didn't.
Yeah. I
mean, or we could have waited until like 1950 or something until we finally decide to free the slaves. And you're just okay, free at last, free at last. Okay, then we're going to wait another 100 years to vote. And, you know, by 2050, then black people will be able to vote. So glad we got the time on that.
Yeah. Right. So, I mean, that's the thing is that they, you know, They're all the technological changes, like slavery was quote unquote dying out before the cotton gin was invented, and then it, you know, drastically reversed course. I mean, so any of those predictions tend to be false, but apparently we're not allowed to teach these things. And if you look at like the secession documents of the early states that were seceding, most of them in the very deep South, they explicitly were like, yeah, we're leaving because of slavery and we want to keep slavery. And that had been the fundamental debate between the Northern and Southern states on every single issue for decades. So it's absurd to say, oh, it just randomly happened that the order of secession almost exactly lined up with the ratio of slaves to non-slaves in the population. The higher the ratio was, the faster they seceded after the election of Lincoln as president. I mean, this was obviously a war about slavery, and you've got people trying to revise the curriculum in that direction, and then she's trying to revise the curriculum in the other direction to say, oh, but actually it was just all la-di-da, magical, voluntary ending, and, you know, there was a great sacrifice, but it was, you know, we as a country decided that we were going to end slavery. No, a part of the country decided that we were going to end slavery. It was mostly the New England states, which they were also benefiting economically from, you know, lower cotton prices and things like that at their factories.
And sugar coming up from slave plantations of the Caribbean.
So, you know, but they basically forced the entire rest of the North to get on board with this agenda of ending slavery, you know, by military force. And, you know, even like Nate said, even the North wasn't unified in how important that particular issue was. They just didn't really want you know, they either didn't want the southern states to leave or they didn't want them to leave violently. Because there were even people, a lot of people in like New York City and stuff, that were okay with letting the southern states secede as long as they didn't go to war with the northern states.
And to move this back a bit away from the nuanced historical questions of the antebellum era and now to this particular protest at, you know, I've been in one of these, you know, school board rooms. It's not usually a big big space in there, so I'm just trying to imagine everyone getting in and speaking their mind. But there was apparently an attempted compromise, basically trying to get some... you know, a curriculum review committee to include some students, teachers, and community members. And then people were not, you know, allayed by that, basically. And, you know, I just want to read a couple quotes from a couple high school kids here because, I mean, they hit the nail on the head. And you just it's impressive to see these people standing up and really, you know, sparking a national issue over, you know, this ham-handed attempt to just, like, slap the curriculum around. So Amanda Stevens... Who has some elementary school children in the district, says they've lost my trust. I'm not seeing actions that reassure me that we'll govern with students learning as our top and singular focus. That's pretty damning. Jackson Curtis, student. What's next? Are you going to choose science? Are you going to take down English? Ashlyn Meyer, we know what we stand for and what we want. Is our education that is at stake? And one more, which I think was actually probably the best. There was a pastor basically talking about the slavery comments. She's willfully ignorant at best, or she's racially disingenuous at worst. She shouldn't be on the education board. That's from a pastor. That's hot fire right there. I mean, that's ridiculous. There was also another... Vietnamese American student, basically, I don't have her quotes right in front of me, but read them a little earlier. Basically, she said that, you know, her family came to America and they've, you know, been so impressed by the ethnic diversity and multiculturalism of this country and how everyone, for the most part, is able to work together and, you know, prosper together. But, you know, she also said that, but we also come here and learned of the history with the internments of Native Americans or of Japanese Americans and atrocities against Native Americans. So we shouldn't sweep that under the rug. And this is obviously coming from, you know, someone who came out of or whose family came out of Vietnam and everything that happened with, you know, after the fall of Saigon. There were tremendous atrocities committed by the communist regime there. So, you know, there are just people coming up and just speaking their piece, saying this is absolutely ridiculous that we're trying to whitewash their curriculum in order to promote what exactly? Just this facile understanding of America's role in the world and its history where, oh, America, it's just, you know, we're just minding our own business and we've done everything well and we're actually the best country and everyone else sucks and we never murdered millions of Native Americans or enslaved black people for like 500 years and denied them rights for like 600. None of that actually happened. It was just like a great struggle and a great sacrifice and then we voluntarily ended slavery. That is nuts.
Yeah, and the wider changes that the school board or the majority of the school board, I think it was 3 members against 2 members, that they wanted to push through were, you know, in addition to the stuff like, you know, more about the founding fathers, more about American exceptionalism, less about the evils of slavery, they also wanted really big concept stuff to be pushed, like more patriotic education. Education that doesn't encourage criminality and violation of the law and protest and civil disobedience. And they also wanted it to be promoting free market ideals and whatever the heck that's supposed to mean in the context of a high school education.
I mean, what exactly, you know, is free market ideals and just, I'm just still a little confused as to what people think that students will learn from a history textbook that'll cause them to go and, you know, commit crimes or civil disobedience or, you know, disregard for the rule of law. Because that's what they say in these quotes coming from the conservatives on the committee. They're concerned that, you know, and it's almost like, are they worried that if, you know, they're afraid that if people read about the civil rights movement, they'll be more likely to, you know, disregard police and, you know, commit crimes and all and sorts of stuff like that.
Ask for their rights.
Well, I mean, we can't have that because that's clearly what these kids are doing in Colorado right now.
Right. This, yeah, they
basically they've taken the lesson to heart and they're trying to prevent them from being civilly disobedient. These people are stripping off their clothes in the middle of traffic and protesting and just going crazy. And yeah, it's very impressive.
They wanted to, quote unquote, discourage protest, I think was one of the curriculum points, whatever, which this is exactly what
backfired tremendously.
Yeah. The level of irony for me that this is happening right now as Hong Kong is experiencing probably its biggest protest in Hong Kong history since at least 1967, and possibly the biggest in China since 1989, you know, and the a few years ago in Hong Kong, there were huge protests as well, led by some of the same people, really, really young activists, as young as age 14, who were saying, we don't accept that Beijing is trying to change the education curriculum to be, quote unquote, more patriotic. And, you know, how are you going to say, look at how great America is and how exceptional America is, we should have patriotic education, when part of the supposed definition of American exceptionalism and the awesomeness of America is that it's not communist and that it's not authoritarian and that it's not sending these messages about, you know, patriotism and no dissent and no protest and whatever. I mean, there's always been people in this country who never wanted that amount of freedom anyway. I mean, that's
there's a large segment of the right in this country that is not, you know, all that interested in, you know, I won't say they're against free speech or, you know, freedom of ideas, freedom of expression, things like that. But there seems to be some sort of hostility towards it.
Or it's only for certain people.
Well, exactly. There's almost like, and, you know, you don't want to go too far down the Godwin road, but there's almost a need to construct an identity that is, you know, very insular and does not highlight and almost glorifies certain aspects of U.S. history. And it's not like this is exactly the same. Oh, okay, this is Hitler Youth. Oh, they're just in dark. We're going to break out the FEMA camps next. Okay, no, that's not what I'm saying. But, you know, you can't get away from the parallels. It's just there is a need in some conservative mindsets, I think, to control the education and just the ideas of young children. All right.
Yeah, and it should only be the positives, that right. It should promote law and order, that it should promote an existing structure and not challenging that structure.
Promote authority to the existing power structure. Do not question that authority under any circumstances. Civil disobedience, not acceptable. You know, freedom of, you know, critical thinking, which is apparently one of the big things they're trying to add to the curriculum. Not okay. We don't want that. All right. So, I mean, this is not the first time this kind of thing has happened. Oftentimes it's also going on with like science curriculums, you know, teach the controversy. Okay. I mean, we even have this in Newton. Like, this is not something that's just limited to Colorado and Texas and all, you know, these places where, you know, maybe it's on a bit larger scale. But, you know, I think we've talked about this on the podcast before.
Yeah.
We have people that come into our school curriculum or school board here in Newton and, you know,
in Massachusetts.
Newton, Massachusetts. You know, it's something I'm fairly familiar with. My dad was on the school board for a while. You know, just basically there are people that'll come in and, you know, we had a large amount of, we have a large Jewish population in Newton, and sometimes issues over Middle East, Israel, Palestine are often very, you know, hot button touchstone. So we'll have people come in basically claiming that they're not the Newton Public Schools is not doing enough to basically demonize Palestinians or Arabs or Muslims.
And some of the arguments that have been made, as we've talked about on a previous episode, have been straight up just complete lies. Like there was somebody who tried to say, I don't know if she actually went to the school board, but she wrote this letter to the editor of the local paper and said, you know, that they don't teach about the Holocaust in the Newton Public Schools, which is literally absurd. Like
that's
you can
a lie.
We studied it from elementary school
onward. I think I read like 10 books about the Holocaust.
Every single year.
In like my years in Newton Public Schools, you know, combined. So
the idea that like, and they would just say that. And it's kind of like in this case in
honestly,
Colorado.
Okay, so just going back from it. We read Holocaust books before it was probably appropriate to read Holocaust books.
Yeah, I think that it ties back to the situation in Colorado in that you know, like Nate was saying to me before we started recording about, you know, the issue of the guidelines versus the rules. And like, it didn't explicitly mention the founding fathers in the guidelines, but obviously the founding fathers are going to come up in the curriculum. And
there's this guy who was super concerned about the lack of D-Day in the curriculum. We got to get D-Day in there, you know, the day that saved American freedom.
Yeah, and so...
Okay, they're going to talk about D-Day if they talk about World War II, and they're going to talk about World War II if they talk about the 20th century. So, okay, D-Day's in there.
Right, continue. So it's like that, you know, that's the like Nate said, this happens in Colorado, it happens in Texas, it happens in Newton, that people will just freak out because, you know, it's not exactly how they wanted the curriculum taught or whatever, and, you know, that there's... you know, they aren't teaching this thing. Well, and they clearly are teaching it, and it's like... You know, just calm down.
And it'd be one thing if they're freaking out to improve the quality of education in the curriculum. I'd love to see someone freak out and say, oh, actually, this little detail in the textbook is, that doesn't actually tell the full story, and, you know, give some sort of dissertation on some obscure historical detail, or just, like, try to improve the standards, you know, try to make sure more detail is taught and people are, you know, thinking critically. But instead, they're just trying to change educational curriculums to serve their own political agendas.
Right.
And that's not something that the U.S. education system... was designed to do, designed to enforce people's own personal viewpoints and biases. If they want to do that, they just send their kids to private school. There's all sorts of special private schools out there that'll teach your kids whatever you want them to teach. So
maybe the education system was designed to teach that, but maybe not intentionally. So at least at a conscious national level, that wasn't the original goal anyway.
Well, it shouldn't be now.
It shouldn't be now, certainly not. And I think I agree with Nate's point, you know, more stuff about Black history, more stuff about Mexican American history. That's been a controversy in Texas and Arizona.
I don't think we learned anything about Mexican American history.
Except for like Zoot Suit riots, probably. So history of various racial minorities, history of, you know, gender and sexual minorities, history of, you know, indigenous populations, all those things, those, you know, agitating for those kind of additions would be beneficial and give a more complete picture. But, you know, saying that it needs to be more patriotic and suppress protest and, you know, American exceptionalism and basically lie about slavery, like, that's not serving any real value to these kids. And if we want to, you know, quote unquote, compete with the rest of the world, which seems to be the other obsession in education reform, then we've got to be teaching actual stuff and not just like weird garbage stuff that fits with the like existing power structure's agenda. Anyway, all right, well, we've got to wrap this segment up here, but Arsenal for Democracy will be right back in just a moment. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey, and still in studio with me is Nate. We're going to talk now about the issue of corporate tax avoidance and a new package of rules put in by the U.S. Treasury Department a few weeks ago to try to discourage corporate tax avoidance. This is something that I think most Americans are, you know, kind of familiar with on an overall basic level, if not how it works. But, you know, this is the general issue of companies in the U.S., trying to avoid or reduce their taxes through legal measures as opposed to illegally just evading the taxes straight up. But one of the trends in how this has been done in recent years is that U.S. companies were merging or taking over generally smaller companies that were based in other countries, like, say, the United Kingdom was especially a prominent target. And the reason for that is that the United Kingdom, although the UK itself theoretically follows all the, you know, rules to try to prevent tax avoidance, the UK actually controls a whole bunch of island tax havens, you know, in the Caribbean or in the Channel. And these places have much lower taxes or almost no taxes at all, you know, and the companies then put their money there, then there's a nominal fee, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, and then there's some countries that just have much lower corporate taxes than the United States, although some of that is like on paper versus reality and that kind of thing. But the result of this has been that quite a few companies have paid, as a lot of people have heard by now, no taxes at all in recent years. These are huge, huge American companies. From 2008 to 2011, 26 major U.S. corporations paid no tax at all, completely legally, without leaving U.S. shores. But that included companies like General Electric, Boeing, Verizon, Mattel, And some of the firms even received net money back from the government in subsidies that outweighed the amount of money that they would have paid in taxes or whatever. And this is all according to the Center for Tax Justice. But these offshore moves, sometimes called offshore reincorporation or inversion, because they're, you know, a bigger company is taking over a smaller company and then making that the main company for tax purposes. This has been really accelerating in recent years. According to the New York Times Dealbook blog, which follows, you know, corporate activities and things like that, almost 25 tax avoidance deals happened from the 2 years preceding the middle of this year. And that was actually about half of all deals ever executed along those lines. And there are legitimate reasons sometimes that companies will, you know, merge with an overseas operation or whatever. But this was specifically, we're talking about the ones that are being done to avoid taxes, to try to reduce the tax burden. And so, you know, the Treasury Department announced toward the end of September a whole package of new rules that are going to try to discourage this action. They're a little bit complicated technically, but they affect things like, you know, how money can be transferred back and forth between the overseas division of the company and the U.S. division, things like that, that make it a lot harder to, you know, just move money around freely, but without getting taxed if it comes into the U.S., things like that. So they want to try to end those sort of practices and make it, you know, revalue the companies depending on where they're located, things like that. Anything that they can do to make these deals less attractive for tax avoidance purposes. So that's what was announced there. And I think it's a step forward. Obviously, the tax havens problem needs to be fixed as well. But this is, I think, a step in the right direction. You know, I think a lot of people don't really necessarily think about, other than, you know, some people think automatically, oh, this is really unfair. But it's like, what is the real harm of these tax avoidance, tax evasion mechanisms? And there's a whole range of harms. But the fundamental, like, basic level thing, which I had argued in an op-ed in The Globalist earlier this year back in May when Pfizer was trying again to make a hostile takeover of AstraZeneca, one of its biggest rivals, not for competition purposes or anything, but solely to try to reduce its taxes by taking over a British company. You know, it's basically in a democratic society, everyone has to be, you know, contributing something. If they're making some amount of money, above a certain level, and they're benefiting from government services and things like that, they need to pitch in and help pay for those things. And the sense is that if these huge companies are very powerful and have these big lobbyists and are avoiding these things, you know, that is going to kind of make everyone else feel like it's unfair and that they shouldn't have to pay their fair share either. And that's a problem that we've seen in countries like Greece and places like that. You know, I think Nate and I had talked about this on a previous episode, but like when you get to a certain point where everyone is evading taxes, or it's seen as very easy for a lot of people to, you know, reduce their taxes kind of unfairly, or that the powerful interests do it, then everyone just stops paying their taxes. And, you know, that then leads to a spiral where the revenues are really low, but then you have to keep raising the taxes to try to make up for the revenue shortfall and all that kind of thing. So there's, you know, there's just a whole range of sort of normative effects that are very detrimental to a lot of countries. And it just really isn't fair that huge companies that are benefiting from all the, you know, infrastructural investments and things like that the U.S. makes at a time of big budget shortfalls are then able to just not pay any taxes or move their money to some other country that isn't doing anything for them at all. But anyway, so Nate, what did you think about these new rules and also the general problem of corporate tax avoidance?
Yeah, just when it comes to corporations having to pay taxes, obviously they would prefer not to. Just it would improve their bottom line and just probably allow them to pocket more money for themselves. So it's not too surprising that many of them would go out of their way to avoid paying taxes, especially now when you have, you know, instant money transfers, all sorts of bank accounts available online, things like that. You're able to move money across the world, you know, almost instantaneously and without having to have, you know, physical, you know, giant buildings or anything like that. This is becoming a pretty major problem in the sense that any American corporation is able to find, you know, various ways to avoid paying different types of taxes. So, you know, maybe that's good for them and improves the economy somewhat, but at the same point, that basically, I wouldn't say it's robbing the government of money, but it's not paying the money that they're supposed to pay. So, I mean, they're being delinquent, they're being whatever, you know, and so I think this is a decent step forward just because, you know, I'm not extremely familiar with this practice, but I could see, you know, it being sort of a backdoor way to funnel money into, you know, the corporations, you know, physically based in the U.S., but maybe getting some of their external financing from overseas. So, you know, just it would just be better if, obviously, every corporation paid their taxes. That's probably not going to happen, just considering how many loopholes there are and how crafty many of these corporations are with their armies of lawyers. But, you know, if this is a step that, you know, can at least get some of the funding back, or at least force them to pay taxes on some of it, then, you know, I think that's a decent step forward.
Yeah, and I mean, the Republican response, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce response to these type of, you know, inversion or offshore reincorporation deals has consistently been, well, this shows the need for tax reform in the U.S. and that we need to cut corporate taxes because we're uncompetitive. And the statistic that you usually see is, oh, the U.S. is, you know, has a like 31% corporate tax rate or something like that. But that's the on paper rate before you start looking at all of these little loopholes and other legal mechanisms. Also, it varies by sector. So, you know, some sectors like retail pay a much different rate than utilities, things like that. So some sectors are paying, you know, well above the amount that's the nominal amount. And then some of them are paying much lower, like closer to 15%. But, you know, theoretically, the U.S. has one of the highest OECD corporate tax rates, you know, among the industrialized economies. But in fact, on, you know, in practice, it's actually much lower. It's significantly lower, more like 20, you know, low 20s. And it's well below the OECD average of corporate taxes. And I think, you know, what that just indicates is that it's not an issue of slashing the tax rate for corporations. That's not the problem here. The regulation is the correct direction to go, not just cutting taxes. If there needs to be tax reform, you know, it needs to be reducing loopholes, reducing subsidies, reducing unnecessary corporate tax credits. Any, you know, inconsistencies in the tax code should be smoothed out so that it is more fair. Any of those things. The answer is not to try to chop the U.S. tax rate down to compete with Guernsey or Jersey or the Isle of Man or Gibraltar or the Cayman Islands or the British Virgin Islands, you know, because there's a lot of these places that exist where if you don't regulate it, like Nate said, it's in the company's quote-unquote interest, you know, at least in the short term, certainly, to try to reduce their tax burden and raise their profits by doing this kind of thing. So, you know, when the Republicans and then some of the Wall Street Democrats say, oh, we've got to cut the corporate tax rate, I mean, that's just not the right approach. It's got to be smoothed out and made consistent. But, you know, you've also got to have those regulations to say, yeah, you can't just try to get out of paying all of your taxes. When you benefit that much from the U.S. economy and the government services that are put into the U.S. economy, you have to contribute money to pay into this. And, you know, it should be in the interest of these sort of, you know, free market people and these, you know, big business people and these companies because, you know, if everyone starts feeling like, oh, the rich always get rich, and which a lot of people do, but, you know, and the wealthy don't pay their taxes, and the corporations avoid their taxes, and they're all, you know, against us, and, like, a lot of people are already starting to feel like that, but it's not just that people are going to want to start evading their own taxes because they feel like it's not fair, you know, like we see in Greece. It's also that there's going to be a tremendous amount of pressure to stop the trend toward globalization and things like that that has made, you know, legitimately, you know, aside from taxes, legitimately easier for these companies to make profits. And you can debate whether or not that's a good idea, but assuming that they think that globalization is a good idea and beneficial to them, that's going to get, you know, the brakes are going to get put on to that if there's a lot of public pressure coming up from the bottom saying, this is unfair, globalization is only a way to cheat people and screw over workers, there's no benefit to the average people, things like that. And so, you know, that kind of thing is just absurd. And when you get quotes from Jamie Dimon from, you know, JP Morgan Chase saying, well, you know, customers want to go to Walmart and buy, you know, things at the lowest prices, so companies should be able to shop around for tax regimes or whatever, like,
yeah,
that's
just decide
that's
if you
want to
live in the Bahamas or Cayman Islands or I guess Gibraltar, and they have pretty low tax burdens, so I mean, just I'd probably go with, you know, somewhere in the Caribbean. It's probably, you know, got some beaches, able to just hang out. You know, probably quite nice down there if you're just going down there on a business trip to just stash your money or something. So, I mean, that's where I'd go if it were up to me. But
right. So
clearly not.
In terms of, you know, making sure that we make up revenue shortfalls, making sure that we have a fair system that everyone, like, can get behind, you know, if they're benefiting from the U.S. rule of law, they need to actually follow the law and not try to, you know, find all the little loopholes in it. All of these reforms will, in the long run, benefit these companies as well as the American people in general. And just, you know, you've got to stop trying to get out of these things because it's going to backfire eventually. And it's going to just cause a lot of problems. So these regulations are necessary and they're a step in the right direction. Obviously, a lot more needs to be done. The UK, for example, we need to put a lot of pressure on them to stop this, you know, weird loophole system that they've got going on, which violates, you know, the EU's own rules on tax havens and such. But this is the direction that we need to be headed. All right, well, Arsenal for Democracy will return in just a moment. Welcome back to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm still Bill Humphrey, and still in studio with me is my co-host, Nate. We're going to talk now about Turkey and their situation in Syria. They've just last week on Thursday, they voted through in Parliament a authorization for the use of military force in Syria, although they still have not actually specified what that would entail, how soon it might start, and how much they might get involved. At a minimum, the speculation is that this would allow the coalition forces, especially the United States, but also some of the ones in, you know, in Europe, potentially, to use Turkish air bases against ISIS positions, both in Iraq and in Syria. Now, in Iraq, it's pretty easy. They can just use the air bases that are in the Gulf, you know, in Bahrain and Qatar and that sort of thing, and fly up the Persian Gulf and into Iraq. And there's not really much hostile territory, you know, whereas if they then have to go to Syria, they have to then fly over, you know, Jordan or Iraq first, and then all the way across like Syrian air defenses and everything, and then get to these targets. So if they, you know, put these, were able to use air bases in Turkey, that would make it much easier to do northern offensives because they could basically just zip in, zip out, and be done, and that would minimize the time that they were in hostile airspace. So that's sort of the minimum scenario for Turkish intervention. We've also seen pitched around in the media, especially in Turkish media, some increasingly bizarre proposals, you know, from your basic invasion, whatever, of the, you know, northern Syria, because they've got all these tanks sitting there now and stuff like that, to actually invading and setting up a special refugee defense zone in northern Syria that would be under the control, I guess, of Turkey. And they're saying, well, we wouldn't be like claiming area, it wouldn't be stealing the land, we would just be creating a safe area, like a buffer zone for protecting refugees, which I feel like that's opening a whole set of like geopolitical can of worms there and a whole new set of problems. But that's something that's been proposed. But the question is whether they would try to put all of the Syrian refugees that are in Turkey, which is somewhere between 700,000 and, you know, 1.2 million back into this area in Syria, and really change the composition, because a lot of the refugees in Turkey so far until recently have been Arab, and this would be a refugee zone in a Kurdish area. So there are some allegations that maybe Turkey is trying to, you know, sort of dilute the Kurdish power in northern Syria, and, you know, affect their own Kurdistan issue. Nate, what do you think the extent of Turkish involvement is likely to be or should be? At what point does it cross from being potentially helpful to being more destabilizing in the situation?
Well, I mean, we just look at the borders that we've been talking about for the past couple months. I mean, they need to be secured. There's been a large amount of just influx of various refugees, and then when there's all that going on, you never know who's slipping from one direction to the other, whether it's various fighters into Iraq, into Syria, or, you know, transferring between those areas. So it's just all very, very difficult, and, you know, it's a fairly mountainous region too, would you say? So that adds to the difficulty. Just in terms of Turkey, you know, we've talked about them a lot on this podcast and how they, you know, what role they are to play in this whole situation with Iraq and Syria. While they have been allies, I guess pretty key allies, and I think they're going to continue to be. There is a story, Bill, if you want to touch on it, about Joe Biden and his relations with the Turkish government, and that, you know, you hope that, you know, there's not some sort of block between the U.S. and Turkey right now.
Well, that's the thing, is that the Turkish government, the military, you know, no matter what party, they tend to be really pushy about, you know, their allies and saying, well, we get to do whatever we want, and, you know, you have to do everything that we want and say everything that we want, or else we won't help you at all. Which, I mean, you know, you want to have countries have their own freedom to do things and whatever, but at the point where they're, like, abusing their sort of relationship to get, you know, live in their weird alternate reality, it becomes a problem.
I find it a little interesting. I was going to say ironic, but it's not really ironic that U.S.'s two biggest allies in the region, not only do they not like each other a ton, they sometimes behave in similar ways. So we'll just leave it there for now. But
right. But anyway, the thing that specifically happened about Biden was that this past week he was giving a speech at the, or doing a Q&A or something at the John F. Kennedy School of Government up here in Massachusetts. This is the Harvard Kennedy School. And at some point, there's a little bit of dispute over whether it's the what he said or the alleged quote that he attributed to the new president of Turkey, former Prime Minister Erdogan, now President Erdogan. But basically, he said, according to the New York Times summary, that allies including Turkey, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates had extended unconditional financial and logistical support to Sunni fighters trying to oust the Syrian government of President Bashar al-Assad. Quote, President Erdogan told me, you were right. We let too many people through. Now we are trying to seal the border, end quote. So this is what he was attributing to the Turkish president. Yeah. Then he said, our allies poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens of thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against al-Assad. And then he included in that, it wasn't necessarily about ISIS per se, but he mentioned Nusra Front, which is the al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. Now, the Turkish government immediately lashed out at this, saying, we have never ever given weapons or support to terrorists in Syria, which I think that's a little bit hard to make that case. A lot of the U.S., you know, weapons have been funneled through Turkey. And obviously Biden wasn't just talking about Turkey. He was also talking about Qatar, which blatantly supports Nusra Front. So that's not in dispute at all. But about that border issue, that was the part that they seemed to react the strongest to. Now, maybe it was because he was quoting something that he shouldn't have been quoting, because if that really happened, it was a private conversation, he probably shouldn't have said it. But as far as everyone knows, even if they weren't directly providing weapons and support, Turkey was letting terrorist fighters cross through, you know, fly in from other countries to Turkey and then cross the Turkish-Syrian border into the situation in Syria. And Turkey is trying to say, and the president is trying to say, that that never happened at all. He said, if Mr. Biden has said such a thing at Harvard, he needs to apologize to us. There was another quote, basically that their relationship would be over or something like that, and that he would cease to acknowledge his existence or whatever. Anyway, and so by Saturday, Vice President Biden had to apologize for this. And again, this isn't like Biden said something crazy or wrong or whatever. Maybe he's causing a diplomatic incident here, but he's saying a true thing that's been an actual problem, yeah. And he's being kind of put on blast for this. Now, Turkey's explanation is that everyone was going on tourist visas to Syria, and how are they supposed to control for that? If you're going as a tourist, then they have no control and they can't say no.
They're just lovely in Syria this time of year.
Right. And, it's exactly like Russia trying to say that all of their Russian troops that have been getting captured or killed or wounded in eastern Ukraine are actually just active duty troops on, like, vacation, you know, some sort of separatist sabbatical, and that they can't possibly control them. You know, and this just goes to all the other stuff about, like, Article 301 of the Turkish Penal Code, where Turkish citizens can't insult Turkishness. That was the original version. That was from 2005. They revised it to say you couldn't insult the Turkish nation. And still, you can't insult symbols and national figures like Ataturk, the founder of Turkey, that kind of thing. You also get all the stuff about the denial of the Armenian genocide. You know, back when Israel and Turkey were, you know, much friendlier, there actually was cooperation there. We've talked about this previously on the show, where like the Israel lobbyists in Washington would apply pressure to make sure that nobody in Washington, like in Congress or whatever, recognized the Armenian genocide as a genocide. And then Turkey just says, well, hey, you want our help on anything? We're a NATO ally. You had better do exactly what we say and like live in our weird fantasy reality. And this is the exact same thing happening again here. And it's like, again, we absolutely need them on Syria. We can't do this without them. And now we're
putting this situation. But they're asking us to just like close our eyes and just like, oh, nothing's happening. Oh, don't, okay, we won't get mad at you, Turkey.
Yeah, I mean, at least the Armenian genocide happened 99 years ago. But like, this is something
where there's still pictures of it. I mean, we still know it happened.
Right, we know it happened, absolutely. But like, that was 99 years ago. This is something that's happening right now.
I also add that it's absolutely shameful that, you know, various members of the Israel lobby would, you know, lobby against recognizing another genocide. Isn't the point to prevent genocide?
Yeah.
Then how does that help? What in what world does downplaying and marginalizing and just pretending a genocide didn't happen, the one that actually inspired Hitler to kill the Jews, in fact, so, you know, it's like, okay, well, you know, on the one hand, we can be, you know, craven servants of current power structure. On the other hand, we could actually fulfill the organization's goal, which is, you know, to prevent genocide or, you know, prevent it from happening, increase education surrounding it.
So, I mean, it literally makes a mockery of the slogan, never forget.
Yeah, just sweep it under the rug as long as it does include the Jews or other groups that we've deemed politically convenient. And let's just forget about the groups like the Armenians that we deem politically inconvenient because of our alliance with Turkey. Although, that's kind of on the rocks too these days, so really it's just a lose-lose for everyone involved.
Now, there's another thing, another development that was particularly interesting with regard to Turkey, and I definitely want to get your reaction on this. So again, like I said, they've now authorized the use of force, but they haven't really decided what the scope of that would be. They may be waiting for ISIS to directly attack Turkey, because ISIS has been very careful so far not to attack Turkey, which makes sense given that that would trigger an Article 5 NATO intervention and force all of the NATO militaries to attack them in Syria, even when they don't want to go into Syria, which is the position of most of the European governments. But anyway, this is an interesting thing that's been happening this year. So Deputy Prime Minister Bülent Arınç raised this the other day, pointed out that there are Turkish special forces stationed at the tomb of Süleyman Shah in an enclave near Aleppo. Now, I had to go research this because I didn't know anything about this. Apparently, ever since 1938, and this goes back to the 1921 treaty between Turkey and the French about where the border was going to be between French-controlled Syria and independent Turkey, there's this historic tomb that has significance to the, you know, founders of the Ottoman Empire, and it's in Aleppo, not like downtown. It's sort of in an outlying area on a river. And they had had, since 1938, Turkey has continuously had troops in Aleppo at this tomb. And, you know, it's this little sort of extraterritorial enclave, a little geopolitical anomaly in the middle of Syria. And Syria has always respected their right to maintain troops there and everything. That's never been in dispute. But their situation has obviously been deteriorating as the sort of civil war gets closer and closer to Aleppo, which is sort of the heartland of the resistance against the regime in Syria. And as we've talked about, Turkey was actively supporting, you know, the Free Syrian Army and those sort of groups that were centered in Aleppo. And in return, their troops that were stationed there were being provided with, you know, intelligence and food and things like that and medicine. Anything that they needed was getting, you know, escorted through basically by these, you know, pro-Turkish or at least Turkish-backed rebels. And that's not that surprising, actually, because during the war between Turkey and France after World War I, Aleppo actually tried to back Turkey because they wanted to be part of Turkey and not part of Syria, even though it's an Arab community, not a Turkish community. And it ended up being the area ended up being divided between the two countries. But what happened this year was that ISIS issued a threat to this tomb, and instead of backing out these troops, the response from the Turkish government was to send in special forces. So they changed from having just random conscripts to having special forces, almost daring anybody to come attack them, and saying that the Syrian government, that they are actively trying to remove from power, that's an openly stated goal, has not done enough to protect their right to maintain their, you know, tomb and their troops there. Now,
that's kind of funny.
The Turkish government's claim is that if this tomb in the middle of Syria were attacked, well, it's not in the middle, it's like 20 miles from the border, but anyway, it's inside Syria. If that were attacked, that should also count as an Article 5 NATO violation. And at this point, the rebels have been falling back, and the ISIS forces have been closing in on that, so they may soon be surrounded there. Whether or not Turkey wants to go into Syria, they may be kind of dragged into this situation. But it's almost like they're maybe trying to be, because they've kind of upped the forces. Anyway, so what do you think about this tomb situation?
It's a little worrying that the future of NATO's involvement is hinging on a couple special forces soldiers. I just looked up a picture of this tomb. It's just like a...
It's like a coffin.
It's
with
like a box
thing. Yeah.
With a shroud over in a hole in a cave or something. Maybe a building. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's a little building on some like island in a river or something like that.
We're gonna go to war over the... I mean, clearly this is a place of great importance to Turkey. So I would think Turkey would maybe want to send a couple more special forces, or I don't even know. But
or just leave for now. It's the middle of a civil war.
I wouldn't want to necessarily get the U.S. and Germany and France and all other NATO countries involved in a like full-scale military operation over, you know, historically important tomb in Aleppo. I think that should be... I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that there's no way NATO should get involved, but I wouldn't say that we should, like,
it should probably be
102nd Airborne to protect the
tomb. A direct and significant attack on Turkey itself, as opposed to this like enclave thing. And I honestly don't think that NATO is going to agree with that interpretation. But the thing is, this is another example of the Turkish government basically demanding that the entire rest of the world see things through their eyes and their kind of fantasy reality of like the importance of Turkish symbols, and that this counts as Turkey, and that it's a fundamental attack on Turkey itself if this tomb gets hit. I mean, things happen all the time. Like, shells land in Turkey periodically from this war, and we don't say, well, that's an Article 5 violation. You know, Article 5 has only previously been used in response to 9/11. You know, so we don't have a lot of examples of, you know, what that kind of when that's supposed to be invoked, but it seems like this is probably not the one, not the time for that.
Wasn't it established for like some sort of
it's for when the Soviets invade Germany
or tank
or whatever.
Invasion or all sorts of...
a tank invasion of West Germany, basically. All right, anything else, closing thoughts on Turkey's involvement in the area?
I just hope we don't go to war over a tomb, but at the same time, it almost seems like that's something like that's going to happen at some point. It seems like we're sliding down the slope pretty fast at this point. So,
all right. Well, Nate, thank you so much for joining me again in studio this week.
Thanks, Bill.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening to Arsenal for Democracy. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Wednesdays. You can also hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Wednesday night at 6 p.m. Eastern. Special thanks to my voiceover man, Justin. You can follow his work at the Digitized Ramblings of an 8-Bit Animal from 8BitAnimal.com. You can get additional commentary at ArsenalForDemocracy.com daily, as well as links to articles discussed today. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message. Good night.